So this is something I found to be just incredibly interesting and thought that I would share it with you today. Again, in Isaiah, God says that about lifting up your eyes and seeing the creation of the stars, the one who led them forth by number, calls them all by their name because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, none of them are missing. Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and justice due me escapes the notice of my God? Do you not know? Have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. And whenever we are going through life and are facing difficulties and crises, we just need to look up to the stars. We need to look at creation and recognize the power and wisdom of God, and that he knows what he's doing and that we can trust him. So what is the strongest evidence in support of the theory of evolution? Is it computational biology demonstrating artificial life? Is it the simplicity of the first simple organism? Or is it the genetic code of animals replicating the phylogenetic tree of life? Or are they all strong arguments or none of them? Because these are really the core arguments of today's evolutionist. Now, I'm a professor at the University of Pittsburgh. I've been there for 27 years, and it's really fun because there are all kinds of conferences and lectures and just about everything. People from all over the world, all the experts come, and I go to as many of them as I can. And there was one that was very interesting called the Epistemology of Modeling and Simulation. And I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting name. And as I looked at the details, they were talking about artificial life and evolutionary genetics and some other topics. And I thought, wow, that could be very interesting. And it was at the Graduate School of Public Health, which was right next door to where I was. And so I signed up and went to the meeting. Now, one of the interesting things is that during one of the major sessions, I heard somebody stand up and say, I hope there are no creationists here, because the discussion pointed out that they had nothing. Okay, and it's just a few years ago. So what is artificial life? This is not artificial intelligence or simulating life where there are intelligent people and teams of people spending years and years and years trying to mimic life. This is the idea that you can develop something more complex from something simple. This is a rebuttal to the second law of thermodynamics that says everything breaks down, and they say in some cases it actually gets more sophisticated. So the development of the advanced and powerful computers, the data, or the idea of creating a special computer program to study the evolution of a simple computer program into a quantitatively and qualitatively more complex computer program began. So the idea is, you know, the DNA code is really complex. We'll just write a computer code that replicates itself very quickly, and we'll build into the code the ability to change one or two of the elements or insert some things just randomly, and we'll put it on a tabletop computer and see if we can run it for a while and something more sophisticated will come out, because that's obviously how we all came here with the DNA, you know, just getting a little bit random mutations, making it more and more sophisticated. Well, this is a very simple experiment. And so they started running it back in the early 80s. And they weren't making much progress. And then they learned about computer networking. And they were able to start linking computers together. And then high-performance computing centers began to develop. And during the off time, they began using this. Then they got other universities involved as well, until around the world, they had a project calling Terra that was the first artificial life program. And it was self-replicating, it had all the random mutations, and the thing would continue to run and run, and they distributed it around the world and ran it for a decade. An incredible amount of computational effort was come, and it was a complete failure. They didn't have a single example where the computer program was qualitatively better or did an emerging concept compared to the original one. And as a matter of fact, there have been at least 20 parallel programs using high-performance supercomputers, and there's nothing. So the conclusion after this incredible amount of work is that injecting random variants into a self-replicating system to generate a new and better system is a complete failure, and they have no idea what to do. The conclusion was that there is no known mechanism to explain how a more complex system can emerge from a simple system without external and meaningful input. They said, we have exhausted such massive resources for this. By this time, it was 2 decades, and come up with nada, which is my Spanish for nothing. And they had a think tank there. They had all the experts from around the world at the University of Pittsburgh. There was about 160 of them. And nobody could come up with any new theory or any way to approach the problem. They were all demoralized because they realized there's no way that even a simple computer program that's in a warm environment would be able to improve itself. And the second law of thermodynamics stands. So there is no such thing as artificial life. You can't generate it from simple to more complex, even with intense replication. They don't want you to know this, but there's no way that a simple thing can become more complex by chance. So that even if all of the components for a living organism were put in the right place, in the right amount, with the right conditions for an infinite amount of time, the complexity of even a simple organism is too complex for it to come together by random chance. So they're saying not only can it replicate, but how do you even get all the pieces together? And even if it did, it would still be dead. Because we know what the parts are, but we don't even know what life is. And this is one of my favorite scientists, Louis Pasteur, who showed that if you take living organisms in healthy broth and kill them, they stay dead. Okay? And his experiments are still sitting in the museum in France, and I was in France, and you know what I found out? They're still dead. The second thing is complexity. And this is actually one of my experiments. Those of you who are interested, this is actually one of the pancreatic cells, and here's where all the digestive enzymes are made. And what we're learning is not only are the cells of the body incredibly complex, but they are precisely regulated. Every step is regulated by feedback systems and motor systems and tracking systems, and it's unbelievable. Now, the pancreas makes digestive enzymes, and what's been found out is not only does it make enzymes, the cell makes things called ubiquitin, which are sensors that are designed to identify when the digestive enzymes are misfolded or prematurely activated or dysfunctional, and it latches onto it, triggers a process in which a couple other molecules are attached on, puts it on a track to pull it away from the part of the cell that's making proteins, and puts it in a thing called a proteasome that breaks it down and puts amino acids out the back end that are ready to be recycled to make new proteins. There are over 600 ubiquitins, and we don't even know what they do yet. So not only do you have a system that can make the right amount of the right enzymes at the right time, but if it goes wrong, there is a backup system that's already designed so that in those cells that need it, but not in other cells, the correct one of the 600 is lined up to link onto it and pull it out of harm's way and recycle it. And even the enzymes themselves have a small tolerance. If you have 30% too much, you're in deep trouble. If you have 30% too little, you're in deep trouble. The control is just incredible. And that's just a fraction. This is the simplest cell, and there are so many things like this. You just go on and on about how energy is done and calcium is regulated and the codes from inside and outside, the next-door neighbors and distant signals and regeneration after injury. It's mind-boggling how complex it is. Now, the thought was that a simple organism was very simple, and so that's how the theory of evolution began. So Robert Hoke got something called a compound microscope, and he could look at tissues and different things, and he came up with a cell theory of disease. And he thought that living cells were made up of these contained units, and they're the basic structural and organizational units of all organisms, and that all cells come from pre-existing cells. And he was right. It was amazingly interesting. But the cells were thought to be full of a gelatin, and they thought it was very, very simple. And of course, the best gelatin and jelly comes from this city, right? From Smucker's? Well, they thought that's what was inside the cells, but inside was actually incredibly complex machinery. They had no idea how complex it was. So the idea that you could have a cell that was alive by a lightning bolt hitting a mud puddle was simple to believe 200 years ago. But now that we know the complexity of a cell, it's impossible. And even the cells that I study inside the pancreas are in an incredibly nourishing and friendly environment. The first organism, if it could even have come to life, would be in a hostile environment and couldn't survive, let alone replicate and lead to life. And so the complexity is no longer even discussed. The components of the first cell is not even discussed, because everyone realizes it's too complex. The other thing was, the pieces are not self-regulated. They're all regulated by DNA that's two or three steps away. And so there are an incredible computational components that are going on to integrate all the information coming from different levels and to determine how much of which protein should be expressed in which cell at what time. And that's coded in the DNA that's away from the part of the cells that are actually doing the action. So it's even more complicated than they ever dreamed, and so they ignore it. Now, as a physician scientist, when I go to work and I study about the pancreatic cells, this is what I think. You formed my inner parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance before I was born, and in your book they were written, the days that were ordained for me, as yet there were none of them. So not only does God pick a fertilized egg and have it develop, knowing it's going to be developed ahead of time and turn into you or your friends or your children. But he has a purpose for that developing living organism that was written in his book before the creation of the world, because he has a purpose for us. And this is what we learn. We were dead in our trespasses and sins, in which we formerly walked according to the course of the world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that now works in the sons of disobedience. But God, through his mercy, saved us. For by grace you have been saved, through faith, that of not yourselves. It is a gift of God, not a result of work, so that no one can boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand so we should walk in them. So the fact that you're living and breathing, and I trust have accepted Christ as your Savior, means he put all of this amazing engineering together to make a living being with a purpose for his honor and glory. And he's mapped out what he wants you to do, and when you're done, at your last day. But he's designed that for you, and you need to get busy doing it. Now, the other thing that's interesting is the whole issue about the mind, brain, and spirit. Because in addition to the reflexive instructions of the DNA in the cell, there are purposed directions coming from the brain. And so the cells are somewhat autonomous, incredible information about how they work, but they're sort of autonomous, and you can actually take them out and grow them in a petri dish, and they start organizing and making organelles and doing those kinds of things they're programmed to do. But higher up, there is things that are not reflex, they're actually purposeful. The problem is that that is what the mind is, and the mind is more than a function of the brain. So neuroscientists have studied all the pieces of the brain, and they can't explain the mind. The brain is designed to sense and to coordinate all the internal and external pieces of information that are coming in about the environment so that the mind can tell the brain what to do. So if you map out the brain, it's basically used to collect and organize all the information, but there's no part of the brain that actually has volition, that actually has purpose, that has understanding and meaning, or that can communicate with God. So the mind uses the brain, but also can interact with the spiritual world, because the mind and the spirit and the soul are invisible. But that is the essence of what God is. And only Christ is human, because he came as a baby and was born human, but God himself is spirit. And those that worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. And so it is our mind and spirit that is the essence. That is the part that God breathed into Adam to become a living being. And the mind and spirit use the brain to move around and to do things on the earth and to do things that are pleasing to God. But you can't explain the higher purpose of man by studying the brain. It just communicates where you are in a three-dimensional location and what the environmental factors are that you should either go toward or run away from. Unless you're a first responder, then you run the wrong direction. So this is where man and God are connected, especially when the problem of sin is removed, because there cannot be a connection between God and man in an intimate way when sin is there, and Christ, by paying for the sin, removes that barrier, and so that relationship between God and man can come together. Now, this is important for life and death. As a doctor, I try really hard, but sometimes my patients die, especially when I was in the emergency room. They were just in an accident. There's nothing we could do to save them. And so we could see them on the gurney and watch their heartbeat, and you know, the family would be in, and you'd watch them, and then they died. And I looked very carefully above and below the table to see what happened, in which direction they were going. And you know what I saw? Nothing, because it was invisible. We don't know exactly what the mind and body is, but we know that when the body is dead, the person is gone. Where did they go? How did they become disconnected? And so death is not the cessation of a pulse. It's the separation of the body and the soul. Life is when they come back together again, and that's what spiritual life is when God's spirit and our spirit are intimately united. Spiritual death is when we're separated. So just like the soul and the body being separated is death and being united is life, so it is with God and our spirit that when we are united, we're spiritually alive, but we're born separated. And that is the beauty of the gospel, is suddenly the connections can be made and we can have a life with God. So last, I'd like to talk about the origin of the species and the genetic code for the evolving branches of the tree of life. Now, this is also out of Genesis 1, and it talked about all the different animals. I want to come to verse 24. Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind. And it was so. And God made beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creeps in the ground after its kind. And God made it, and it was good. So there was not a primordial organism that branched out. God created them as individual species. Now, within a species, there's a lot of variety. For example, a dog. So you take a wolf and start breeding it, and you can breed it into a Chihuahua or a French poodle, there's incredible variety. Great Danes, they're all dogs, but they're not cats. There's all kinds of cats, but cats are cats and dogs are dogs. That is what a kind is. And what God says is that he created each animal as their kind. Now, what's fascinating about this is that all of the parts necessary to build the cells that make the animal are the same. It uses the same raw materials so that everything that is used to make a cat can make a person. Everything that making a cow can make a person. As a matter of fact, you can grow just by eating a dead cow. Okay? People can actually eat plants. They're called vegetarians. And all the pieces that are there, they just get reorganized and built together. The difference is in the genetic code that tells how each of the pieces is to come together and how the cells are to organize them and change their shape and to signal each other. And it's the DNA that actually determines what the animal looks like, what it does, and how it responds. Now, this is the tree of life that we talked about before, showing everything coming up to these little twigs at the top. How in the world did this happen? Well, the organization of the tree of life was designed based on the size and the shape of the animals. Okay? So just like I showed with the chimpanzee and all the missing links coming up to a human, you can take, tiny horses and line them up, they're bigger and bigger and bigger, or you can organize between the different animals to suggest what's happening. The key difference is the genetic code, okay? Because the code tells you what kind of animal it's going to be. And if evolution were true, then the accumulation of new mutations should track through each branch so the entire tree can be rebuilt based on genetic ancestry. Okay? And we've got computers can do that, and we have sequenced the entire DNA sequence of hundreds of animals and plants, everything in between. So all the data is there. Now, how many of you have heard of 23andMe or Ancestry.com? Okay? I was actually at a conference in Santa Cruz, and I met the people that do the Ancestry.com, and it's actually fascinating. They started as a publishing company, and what they did is they did ancestry research and tried to go to, you know, the county halls and to Ellis Island, and they put these genealogies together, and then they started finding out that people wanted to track each other by DNA, so they put the pieces of DNA together and tried to organize it and put their family history together, and it is unbelievable what they're able to do. I mean, the issue now is that they're able to find a murderer by finding a DNA from 25 years ago and by looking at their DNA, figure out who it was. Not because they're matching with a person they know, but they can replicate where they came from and who they're related to. Okay? And so what they're able to map out for the human ancestry is absolutely amazing. So the first thing they showed is, how many human races are there? One. And so when I have to fill out forms for my research, for the government, you have to say, what race are they? And they list all the races you have to do for some kind of equality thing. And I just cross it out and I put ancestry, because that's really what they're talking about, is ancestry. And so the computer ability to sort out this entire ancestry thing is incredible. So at the conference, I went to the evolutionary genetics thing, and there was a very distinguished and self-righteous professor that was talking about his research. And I said to him, I said, sir, I have a question. He said, you're showing the relationship between bacteria of the same species and how they adapt to antibiotics. I said, the question I have is, why haven't we seen how all of the different animals are structured in the tree of life? Because it should be simple to be able to track the genetic mutations to see how they're organized. Well, it was a trick question because I knew the answer. Depending on what the function of the molecule is, it'll have similarities, and the same motifs are used in different animals, but they don't connect anywhere. And he said, well, we all know that this is a difficult problem. We've worked on that, and none of the algorithms for tracking ancestry seem to work. We think there must be some kind of a higher level of genetic interaction that's explaining this, because we just haven't been able to reproduce the tree. And I said, have you showed the convergence of two species that are similar with each other? He said, no. Okay. So what the evolutionists do not want you to know is that this is a myth. This up here at the top is a reality. It's all twigs with no branches. None. The whole thing is a myth. The hardcore evidence has to be the genetics, and there is zero genetic evidence for a single organism developing into all the different species and plants and animals and fungi. As a matter of fact, they can't even find small branches between different species. So the origin of the species question has been solved. And you know what the answer is? That's the way God created them. Now, how many people have heard this before? Well, that's interesting. That was a secret that the evolutionists did not want you to know, but it's true. So where are the missing links? Well, the theory at Darwin's time was that with time, the missing links would be found to build the tree of life. This is lining up things by what they look like. But all the branches are still missing. Since Darwin, 150 years ago, they haven't found a single link between the branches. And the evidence that the previous branches were there, but we haven't found them yet, by using genetic ancestry is also missing. So in conclusion, the theory of evolution is an attempt to explain the existence of man without God or miracles. Over the past 60 years, the critical evaluation of the mechanisms of evidence using tests to look at these theories has consistently supported the biblical record and destroyed the prevailing theories of evolution in every area. The evolutionary theory continues to morph to avoid the shortcomings. So the original theory is that everything continued the way it has and all this stardust piled up until the Genesis flood came and proved that there had to be a catastrophe. And so they finally said, yeah, there's a catastrophe, but it was a meteor that hit the earth. It was a comet that came by and got it out of kilter. It was climate change. It was this, it was that. It was anything but a flood, even though if you dig below your feet and look, it's screaming global flood, which is anathema to the evolutionist. And there's no tree either. There is no tree of life in the evolutionary belief. All there is all the species independent, and they've only been there for about 10,000 years, no longer. But through selective breeding, we can get little purse puppies for those who want one. The new approach then is to have experts that state what's true and what you're to believe. Okay, because they're scientists and they tell you, this is what you're to believe. And they ridicule, mock, and shout down anyone who questions their authority. Did you know that's what's happening? That's why what you're hearing is evolution, and you don't hear anything else because the people are being shut up and shouted down, the microphone's taken away, and they're threatened. And for you young people, this is the world that you're living in, and what I've seen at the university over the 20 years that I've been there is an amazing disintegration of every moral, godly influence except for a few shining stars that are still there. But you know what? The Most High Lord God reigns. He's either sovereign or not, and I know he is sovereign. And in the end, he will take his stand on the earth, and he will bring justice to the world and reward those who are found faithful. And so what I wanted to do today is to encourage you that if you believe the Bible and if you know who the Creator is, you're on solid ground. And nothing that you see on television or in comic books or in children's things or anything that says otherwise is false. That the true scientist trying to solve the problem of evolution agree that there is no mechanism. They have absolute idea, no idea how they got here, and there's no evidence for evolution at all. And they made one big mistake. They said they were hoping there was no creationist there, but I know there was at least one. And I came to tell you their secrets. Thank you.